Welcome to the Digital Leaders Podcast. My guest today is Sabi Gill. Sabi is Executive Vice President and Managing Director, United Kingdom and Ireland at Sage. He has more than 33 years experience in the technology sector across direct sales, operations and customer service, with significant experience working in the channel partner ecosystem. Sabi says, "I'm an extremely passionate advocate for the technology sector and the importance of digital transformation in business for competitive advantage." Welcome, Sabi, and great to have you on the Digital Leaders Podcast.
Thank you, Robin. I'm delighted and honored to be part of this program.
I'd really like to find out more about what you do. I've introduced you already and sort of explained what your day job is, but what is your day job?
So my day job, Robin, is I think I've got probably one of the best jobs in the industry. I work as the UK and Ireland Managing Director for an organization that pretty much started its journey 40 years ago when two university graduates got together in a pub, as most graduates do. And also probably the best place to come up with an idea and to be conceived is in a pub. You know, Sage started as a small business many, many years ago. And we understand probably more than anybody, you know, the slings and arrows that business owners face. You know, we have a desire back then, and I think we've done extremely well in achieving it, in really supporting and having a passion towards SMEs and small businesses, really ensuring that we're able to empower those owners to drive their business. We did it then, and we're doing it today. As an organization, we floated on the stock exchange back in 1989, and in 1999, we entered the FTSE 100, where we are one of the only organizations to have ever remained in the FTSE 100 since then. We reach millions of customers globally, we have crossed 23 different countries, and we are one of only two technology companies that are part of the FTSE 100. We've been, you know, as I said, 40 years. Next year, we actually celebrate our 40-year anniversary. So, you know, my role is really to lead 3,000 colleagues across UK and Ireland. You know, we have about half of our entire workforce are based in our office in the Northeast, where we were founded and conceived over those that 40-year period. And look, in the UK, we pay 51% of people that work within the private sector through our software. And globally, $4.2 trillion annually moves through our Sage software. So for us, it's, you know, and for me personally, it's a huge honor to lead an organization that operates globally, but really to lead that organization in its home market is really what I do, and hopefully what I do best.
Some great stats there to help us understand the scale of the organization. Obviously fantastic that you're a FTSE 100. You're obviously firmly a technology business. And I guess that's, you have always been a technology business, just kind of probably ahead of the curve, I guess. That's fantastic sort of accreditation, 40 years in business. But you personally, I'm not entirely sure how long you've been with Sage, but what's been your journey to this great job you've got now? So, you know, was it your grandparents, your parents, a teacher, you know, sort of what's been your route into this role?
Do you know what? Interesting enough, it was by accident. It was back in, you know, back at the ripe old age of 16, back in, you know, many years ago, back in 1984, that I took a summer job for what was at the time probably one of the most prestigious and well-known, I think then you could have called it bleeding edge hardware mainframe infrastructure providers. And it was called Digital Equipment Corporation. And it's an organization that doesn't exist anymore. However, it was acquired by Compaq. Compaq was then acquired by HP, and HP is in existence today. And interestingly enough, you know, when I started my role, back at when I was 16. I started in the finance department, and I was there on just during a summer term doing a YTS scheme, as it was sort of known back then, part of a youth training scheme. And it was only a summer intern job that I took. But the great thing about the organization was, you know, I was flung into something then that I didn't really understand what it meant, was FP&A, so financial planning and analysis. And you could imagine back then, back in 1984, it was very paper-based. It was, you know, VDUs, it was VT220 terminal, almost hardware emulators. And, you know, there wasn't really that true concept of PCs. They were really, really being introduced. And interestingly enough, you know, the very first PC that was given and used by the organization was actually given to me. They sort of looked at me and sort of said, hey, you're the youngster. You probably get to understand this more than any of us can. So it'd be great if you could just get to know the program, understand it. And I, you know, up until then, I'd probably be at school, dabbled in a bit of programming and that sort of stuff. But that was really my first inroads into, you know, the digital sector and really understanding, you know, accounting software. Because, you know, the first package that we had, it was, you know, Lotus 220 spreadsheets, and everything was spreadsheet based. You imagine for an organization like that, working in an FP&A organization, everything was spreadsheets, everything was, you know, pulling macros together and pulling all of the data. So for me, it was just a huge insight into how big corporate organizations work. But the potential was just massive. That really started my curiosity into accounting and really my curiosity into technology. It was then during that first journey, and I stayed there for 10 years. And, you know, during that 10-year period, I just concentrated on financial accounting software. Yeah, I did various, there was packages back then that were referred to as Ross Fixed Assets. And then I was responsible for their general ledger product. Then they gave me access to an internal system, which I remember called Gears. And then the last system I was responsible for was SAP. And little did I know how big SAP was. To me, it was a big mainframe application software package that I was responsible for implementing into you know, a small division within the business. And at the end of it, I was actually the European implementation manager for SAP. And that really, really broadened my horizons. And from there, I was headhunted and joined another software company that was little known then, which is a company called PeopleSoft. I stayed at PeopleSoft for 10 years. That got acquired by Oracle. And then that was my whole inroad into, you know, financial, accounting, software, business packages, ERP. So yeah, it was all by accident. You know, that ripe old age of 16 is really being exposed and being given that that first PC in the department that really opened my eyes on what technology was available, what we could do with it. And for me, I've never looked back.
So it's good to know that something's never changed, that the young people in the department get looked at when the new technology arrives, with a sort of general hope that they're going to be the enthusiasts. So that's, I mean, that's a great journey. And as you say, kind of by accident, by luck, definitely an element of right time, right place. So, I mean, are you paying that back, you know, kind of when you see young 16, 18-year-olds, you know, kind of arriving into the business, what sort of advice would you maybe share back with them? I'm sure Sage has a big apprenticeship program.
Yeah, we do. And it's a, you know, it's a great, being one of the biggest employers up in the Northeast, our apprenticeship and graduate program is really important. You know, I play a strong part with Sage Foundation. We have a real strong partnership with Peter Jones's Tycoon program, which is really about involving schools and individuals and people around running their own business and then having mentors within the organization. I've been involved in that since it's, you know, it was introduced into us probably about 2 years ago. And since then, I've also been involved in the Veterans Program, which is also part of the Peter Jones Foundation. Then over and above that, on an annual basis, we do get a significant amount of apprentices, graduates joining the program. To me, it's probably the most enjoyment that I get is actually going up to the grad bay that we've got up in Newcastle, spending time with them. Being based up in Newcastle, had a couple of nights out with them, and they're a great group of individuals, and you learn so much. I remember during the initial workshops that we had with them during their induction period, and I went and spent some time with them, just introducing them to the values and behaviors and, our culture. And some of the questions that you get from individuals just gives you some real insight in relation to what's their priority. And a lot of the things that they ask about are things like, so what do you do around CSR? What are you doing around foundation? What are the things? And they love to hear more about what we do around culture and those elements. So it is a totally different mentality. My piece of advice to anybody coming in is make sure that you absolutely embrace all of those different components that are available to you, the learning, the culture, the development elements, because, organizations now hopefully will be more than just a job. You spend probably just as much, if not more, time with your work colleagues than you potentially do with family members. And for me, that's an important aspect of any culture, is building an organization that is like a family, that people support each other. And, you think about times like we're currently going through with COVID, it's probably even more apparent now the importance of that ecosystem of individuals and people and the network that you have around you. And for me, that's probably the most important advice that I would give anybody, is make sure that they embrace and use the opportunity to get to know their teams, the organization, live and breathe the values and behaviors that are available to you. Take full advantage of all of the learning and development, because that's how they'll be able to, almost forge their own future, but only if they are open to all of the things around them and embrace them.
Yeah, I think that sounds like good advice. And obviously we're recording this kind of in a week after A-level results and the day before GCSE results come out, which has been an incredibly stressful, tough time for young people. Are Sage doing their bit this year? Are you still able to keep those apprenticeship spots open? I mean, I know how incredibly difficult it is for all businesses, but I guess the Northeast are heavily reliant on organizations like yourself to give people their style.
Absolutely, Robin. And if anything, what we're trying to do is look for more ways of actually expanding that and seeing if we can actually take on more within the various groups and opportunities that we want to make available. It's such an important part of our culture of ensuring that, especially up in the Northeast, of bringing in fresh blood and individuals and allowing people to come in at various levels within the organization. So, most people, when they think of graduates and apprentices, they always think of, people leaving for school, university, and those sort of things. For us, we've got return to work, mothers, we've got people who have veterans who have left the armed forces who are joining us. For us, it's really ensuring that whoever you are, we give you an opportunity to join us. And, the more the merrier at the moment. I've been involved in a number of onboarding programs, even during lockdown. We've continued to do that every single month. I spend a good couple of hours with our onboarding team. Every individual who joins us goes through an onboarding activity with us, even remotely. If we were back in the office, every individual would always be invited up to Newcastle to spend their first 2 or 3 days in employment, getting to know us as individuals, people, getting to know the senior leadership team, and making sure that they have the best opportunity from day one to succeed in the roles that they're in. But they understand that they're not on their own, and that there is this big organization with 3,000 other people right behind them and right by their side when they join us. So for us, it's a huge part, and will continue to play a huge part for us going forward in our recruitment strategy.
Two quick supplementaries from me on that. So one is, what would you say to a young person wanting to get into tech when he's or she is balancing up joining a small startup or joining a FTSE 100 business like Sage? What are the issues there or the opportunities Sage can offer?
The easier way of looking at it is when you're joining an organization like Sage, where we've got 3,000 fellow colleagues in the UK, and joining a organization that also operates globally. We have over 600,000, close to a million different organizations, businesses, depending on what user count you use on. Is it businesses? Is it users? And that sort of thing. But we touch a lot of people in the UK. Joining an organization that has so much variety, opportunity, for me is the most important thing, because you don't want to be... It's great joining a small organization, and most small organizations will give you that first step, will give you that opportunity, but will they be able to give you your longer term growth aspirations and variety of tasks and jobs and different activities that you may want to do? It's the variety of the role. We offer that. Whether it's customer service, customer support, you want to be customer facing on that front line, or whether or not it's, you want to be in the finance group, you want to be in the back office, you want to, just be involved in processing type related activities, or you want to go into development. So an organization the size of Sage, we offer a lot of different roles, variety. And again, that it really depends on what the individuals are after. Sometimes you need to do that small business organization. And most organizations in those are, tend to be fairly niche if you're in the IT or technology sector. But there's, again, there's huge opportunity. So I wouldn't say that, only go big. For me, it's really about what best suits you as an individual. And then, take time to make sure that you find the most appropriate role for your longer term aspirations. So yeah, look, it's important that every individual doesn't just automatically choose the first opportunity that's available to them.
My second supplementary is about women in tech. So the government's pretty good at it. It's kind of the size and scale that it can consciously, positively bring women and focus on women into the tech space. But Sage must be able to do that as well. And are you doing it?
Yeah, we are, Robin. And look, I'm a real big advocate for that. Just over a year ago, I actually headlined and was a keynote speaker about women in tech and, really being, how can men be an advocate for women when it comes to being in technology. Literally just over a week ago, we actually sponsored Women in Tech Awards for the UK. I was, again, honored to present that award. Look, in the UK, when you look at things like gender pay gap, right? We've reduced our gender pay gap percentage in relation to between men and women quite significantly over the last year. 50% of my entire UKI leadership team are women. It's something that I take personal pride in, something that I really work hard with all of my leadership team to make sure that that doesn't only happen at my level, but it's something that we closely monitor throughout the entire organization. Our recruitment strategy is to ensure that, for some of the, more established roles that would normally have been predominantly male based, right? So for example, when you think about development roles, our organization is predominantly men. But when we look at recruitment and our recruitment strategy now going forward, we're looking at all of the different aspects around. So how do we now get to women in tech? How do we try and ensure that we're getting into universities, and we're making sure that when we go through recruitment drives, we go through career fairs, that we're attracting individuals and people of both sexes, and it's not predominantly just male. But it's a huge, it's a great area of focus for us, and long may it continue.
Brilliant. So what are you focused on right now? What is getting you out of bed in the morning and that needs to be done?
Well, I think the big thing for me at the moment is, it is all about digital. It is all about digital and the way that digital has been transforming the way that we work, the way that we engage. When we think about So when Sage started its business almost 40 years ago, compact discs were a revolutionary way of transferring and receiving data. Mobiles weren't even invented to the extent that they are now, right? And, you know, you think about the internet and search engines, a lot has evolved over the last 40 years. And for us, it's all about agility and greater access to information and insights is what makes a difference for organizations today. It's all about, you know, data. So if you think about things like, you know, IDG Insight, you know, showed us most recently financial applications, and the area that Sage are involved in today is the fastest growing cloud sector when you compare that against things like, you know, payroll and ERP and everything else. So for us, probably more pertinent today than it's ever been at any point in time is really ensuring that businesses are using their ability to get to a wider audience of customers, use technology to do it, optimize supply chains. You think about everything that we've been experiencing around COVID now, the organizations that are coming out better than they went in, or just, you know, at least to even, you know, pre-COVID levels, are those in organizations that have absolutely embraced technology, have gone to e-commerce, have been able to still sell their wares, but maybe using it through online purchases as opposed to having expect people to come into their stores and shops, which have been closed during this period. So for us, it's all about information. It's about access to information. It's about getting using technology to that wider audience. You know, last year, you know, 50% of companies worried about exactly all of the things that they've had to go through and adopt now. So last year, people were worried about security. People were worried about, you know, access to information. Now, I would say post-COVID or during COVID, those things have sort of gone out of the window, and it's about survival. And in order to survive, technology has just been the biggest savior, I would say. And it's going to also be probably the biggest differentiator. And let me explain to you what I mean by that. When you think, go back to the financial crisis in 2008 and 2009, most of the organizations and the types of organizations that employed the most amount of people and really dominated business recovery were SMEs. It was the small, medium businesses. It wasn't the big, large corporate organizations that went out and hired, you know, thousands and hundreds of thousands of people or millions of people. It was the entrepreneurs. It was the small organizations. It was the organizations that then really started to build. And for me, that's where I believe coming out of COVID, we're going to see a lot of startups. We're going to see a lot of organizations, small, medium businesses, really take full advantage. And it's going to be those that take technology and use that information and data being the real most important thing, to really take full advantage. Because if you think about data specifically, it's really the key and probably will influence the type of tech that is created and moving forward. It's like 2.5 quintillion bytes of data created each day at our current pace. I didn't even know that word existed, right? Quintillion. But that pace is only accelerating with the growth of, you think of Internet of Things, you think about 5G networks and technology, when almost anything and everything is connected. You know, over the last 2 years alone, 90% of the data in the world was generated, right? Just literally in the last 2 years, 90% of the entire world's data was generated. And to me, that's where I believe we can play a big part of understanding and allowing businesses to understand how to use that data to their advantage. And really, for me, small, medium businesses, after the once COVID is, it's never going to end, but you know, once we can help people get through these lockdowns and start the recovery phase, that's what I believe our job is, to help people understand how they can use information, consume it, and make key informed decisions about their business. Because I think business models will be very different to what they were today.
Yeah, I think data is, and the opportunity of data is huge. And I don't really expect you to answer this question, but I do sort of want to ask you, does that mean that Sage won't be an accounting software business in 5 to 10 years' time, because it will be pursuing and playing a big part in that data piece beyond the current day job.
I absolutely agree with that comment. I think Sage is very different to what it was when we originally started and what we even conceived to be, you know, a year, 2 years ago, right? When you know, we own financial accounting, right, in the UK market and in most markets globally. But we're more than that now. Right? When you have, you know, that many trillion dollars, $4.2 trillion dollars annually moving through our software, when you're responsible for paying over 50% of the entire UK private sector workforce, we are more than just an organization that does accounting software. You know, when we are processing that amount of information and data for organizations, for us, having that data and ensuring people understand what that data means to their business, you know, we're not going to be processors or, you know, custodians of it. What we will be is we'll be enablers. We'll allow people to enable them to use that data to give them informed business decisions and allow them to be able to make informed business outcomes that are positive to whatever sector that they're in. So yes, I believe that we will play a bigger part to them and become more important to their success. Because, you know, you think about automation, you think about AI, you think about machine learning, you think about all of these different fourth generation, you know, almost fifth generation type technologies that are now coming to market. For us, it's really about how do we use that technology to allow the businesses to make better decisions about what's going on, and also not only better decisions, because data is one important part of it, but then it's like, how do we allow people to transform their business? So using machine learning, how do you use AI? How do you use different types of technology that allows those businesses to be more efficient, more effective, be able to have resilient business processes that allows them to stay constant contact with their customers and their employees through the use of technology, and then be able to use that data to their advantage. And I think that's what we will become. We'll become that, you know, real strong advisor, that business partner to those organizations so that they can be successful in whatever sector and whatever business that they operate in, but allowing them to be agile and make changes along the way. Because we know probably one of the biggest constants is change. COVID has shown us that, if anything, about how organizations needed to almost on a dime within a 24-hour period send, you know, I had to do it. I had to send 3,000 people home, work from home. All of a sudden, a different business process, different business practice. Technology played an important part of that. If I didn't have that technology and we didn't have cloud-based applications, how would I ever have been able to do that if I was reliant on individuals who were running a payroll environment, sending everybody a pay slip? And then, you know, if that wasn't automated in any way, I would never have been able to, you know, operate in the way that I was.
This is the Digital Leaders Podcast, so we have to talk about digital leadership. And I think what you've just been saying in a way is that having a conversation with a leader about why digital is an important part of their skill set has probably got easier since COVID-19 sent us all home and we've had to make the sorts of changes that you've described. But what for you are the qualities you're looking for in a leader that kind of lets you know that they understand and embrace digital?
The most important piece for me, right, and there's probably different lessons learned for me over the last 3 to 6 months since COVID's been going on, is it's ensuring that individuals and people have empathy. Because, you know, it's great having, you need individuals that really understand people and making sure you take colleagues along with you on the journey. Because you can introduce whatever technology that you want, but people have to believe in what you're doing and the way that you're asking people to adopt and take on technology. And leaders who can bring people along with them have a greater possibility of accepting technology and change within an organization than anybody else. It's that trust factor. So for me, it's almost like, you know, if I was hiring a new leader today, I'd almost be looking at CV and saying, well, and it's one popular question and everybody knows me for it, is the question I always ask everybody is, tell me what the CV doesn't tell me about your leadership style. Because I can see that, you know, somebody who's been a manager, somebody who's been a leader of a sales organization, somebody who's achieved. But for me, it's all of the components around, tell me what it doesn't tell me about you as a leader. What are the things that somebody would tell me about you, not about, you know, how well you performed and, you know, whether or not you made, you know, sales club or elite programs and that sort of stuff. But I want to know about you. I want to know about what is it that, you know, what's your secret sauce about being leadership? So that's the big thing that I would always be asking individuals and people, because I think that plays an important part in leadership in general. But then the digital leadership element for it really comes about of understanding what technology can do and the difference it can make to an organization. Because you've got to understand the outcome of what it is that you're asking people to do. So if I ask people to take on a new e-commerce site or take on, you know, the importance of banking solutions, I better know what the important thing is that that then drives to that individual that solves a pain point. And that's the reason why that empathy piece I was mentioning right at the beginning comes back in, because empathy around even introduction of technology does come down to, so what pain point does it really fix? And how can you emotionally tie that into an individual? Because that's the way I operate. And I think it's where most individuals is, especially in sales, is if I can find the pain point from you, Robin, and take it away from you, right? And guess what? If I can do that with technology and I can automate it and I can give you all the rules and take and find and guarantee that it's going to stay up there and do all of that. But it's all about taking that pain away from you. And if technology can play that part and having a leader who can bring all of those things together is nirvana.
Well, that's a good moment, I think, to begin to draw a close to our great conversation today. So as our listeners know, we always close on a quick fire round. So Sabi, give us the book that you would recommend that our listener reads.
So for me, there is a book, and I've met this person, and the book is called No Higher Honor. And it's a memoir of Condoleezza Rice, a memoir of her years in Washington during that 8-year period. And, you know, a lot of people probably know her, but, you know, she was a former national security advisor. She was a secretary of state. But, you know, when I had the pleasure of meeting her, and it was right at the, you know, a couple of months just before Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton were going through those final stages of their campaigns around who was going to become president, I remember just, you know, just talking to her and having a conversation around, you know, what she thought of the you know, the race to the White House and everything else. And, you know, there was an individual who just absolutely knew what almost was going to happen. And I think going back then and seeing the insight of almost what that first term happened, she almost nailed it to what sort of things were going to happen and, you know, how well he was going to run that program. And she's a very, very inspirational lady and woman. And, you know, for me, the book is a absolute first-class read if anybody wants to understand some of the challenges that were going on, you know, challenges during 9/11, what were the things which you had to deal with in the Cold War. So for me, that would be my suggestion.
Well, an inspiring woman of color who's probably slightly forgotten. So thank you for bringing her back into our conscience. It sounds like a great read. So who would you like to have lunch with, living or dead, and why?
Yeah, this is quite an easy one. You know, when I was, I think it was probably when I was back in at PeopleSoft in the year 2000, I'd lost my mother in an unfortunate car accident. So, you know, for me, it would always be, you know, having the ability to spend time with her And then just being able to, you know, give her an update on how things had gone since, you know, since she's passed away, and then being able to just share memories and thoughts of, you know, the family and the time that that she missed. So for me, that would always be, you know, top of my list, Robin.
Well said. And finally, what one thing about you, Sabi, would our listener be surprised to find out?
For those people who are part of British Airways executive program will know that there is something in their website called Flight Path. And what it does is it gives you the ability to understand and track how many miles you've flown, hours in the air, cities visited, countries visited, and how many times, if at all, you've been to the moon. So, you know, I think what people would probably not know about me is I've spent over 2 million miles flown. And this is just with British Airways. Over 4,100 hours in the air, which is almost 6 months of my entire life in the air. I've visited over 80 cities from the UK. So this is UK back out in 40 different countries. And the most, interesting stat, which my kids still don't believe, is I've been to the moon 8.7 times. And again, that's only with British Airways. So if I included all the other times when I lived abroad, and I was living in the US, I lived in Singapore, lived in Australia, and spent some time in all of those different countries. And I was, but it wasn't, British Airways wasn't necessarily my airline of choice. So it just gives you an idea. So when people turn around to me and say how old I am, I'll give them two ages. One, my official age, and then the age of the amount of time I've spent on the earth as opposed to in the air.
And a slightly geeky question. What's the best aircraft you've flown in their fleet?
I would say it's gotta be the latest planes, right? The 777, the 787. Those are, it's just a totally different experience, right? Now British Airways have now just taken and decommissioned all of their 747 200s and 400s. They were iconic, but for me, you know, the new technology that's being now put into these new planes and allowing to, you know, quieter, more efficient, longer, really does make a difference. You know, that smooth ride when you're flying that many hours is always the thing that you look for more than anything.
And did you fall in love with the double deckers or not?
Yeah, I did. Right, probably more the 747 400s and the 200s and those double deckers rather than the double deckers now. You know, when you're on, you know, lived in Dubai and then, you know, the big Emirates double deckers that they used to have. To me, they're great, but it just seems like any other normal plane because you don't really realize how much of a double decker it is and whether you can't remember whether or not you got on the first floor or the upper floor. Whereas in the 400s and the 200s, you always knew you were at the front of the plane. You took that one gangway, which was going up, and it was the same one coming down. There was only like about 22 seats up there. And that used to be great fun, right? It was almost like you were in a small little club as you took those seats.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for satisfying the plane geek in me. I thoroughly enjoyed that close. Sabi, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the Digital Leaders podcast.
Excellent, Robin. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
That is it for this episode of the Digital Leaders podcast. Now, of course, we would love to know your thoughts. Tag us at DigiLeaders and let us know. And if you want to find out more about today's guest, head on over to our website, digileaders.com/podcast, and we have all that information there. That is it for this week. I'm your host, Robin Knowles. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back soon with another episode of the Digital Leaders Podcast.